Welcome to Talking Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us have a passion for just taking a walk. I'm on Sutton Heath in Suffolk with Henry Fletcher, author, wayfinder, and wilderness guide turned walking artist. I'm fairly confident that I'm not going to get lost, as Henry has more than a decade's experience in guiding people in Iceland in much harsher conditions than we're encountering on a spring day in May. With the help of Jay Simpson, a fellow trail maker and workshop facilitator, they authored the Banff Mountain Literary Award-winning Wayfinding in the West Fjords, along with a companion trails map and two other guides to the local ecology and walking conditions. The books include reflections and responses from scores of participants who've taken part in artistic residences and trail restoration workshops that Henry and Jay devised and led. By raising money for the publication through a Kickstarter crowdfunding campaign, they were able to hire book designers, botanical illustrators, as well as translating the books. It turns out that although they have created far more than a walking guide, with a book filled with beautiful photographs and artwork, Henry, as a self-proclaimed wayfinder, isn't someone inclined to use a guidebook or to follow a well-marked trail. So I'm intrigued how in creating this suite of books and map may have modified his own practice. Similarly, he's an enthusiastic supporter for the World Trails Network, for which he created a film festival and a series of artist talks. When you were driving here and we just parked up, I jokingly said, well, I don't really have to worry about anything because I'm with a wayfinder. But do you ever get lost?
I'm actually more of a wanderer than a wayfinder, in that there's a little running joke between Jay and I. So Jay is the person who I completed this work with in Iceland. He is a map maker, and as we were completing our maps and guidebooks to the Westfjords of Iceland, we kind of joked between each other that these are materials that I would never use. Because whenever I set foot out to go for a walk, yeah, my preparation is minimal, and that extends to my clothing and my map resources. And I'm definitely a wanderer at heart and enjoy getting lost. So in Iceland, it's a little tricky to get lost because the landscape is treeless, essentially. So you can always pick where you're going and generally see the route ahead of you at all times, unless the weather descends. So yes, occasionally if there's a lot of fog around, I remember one time climbing up a very familiar mountain, getting to the top, and there's a dense pea soup on the top and you can't see more than 5 meters in front. And I was guiding a group of artists and I had a GPS device with me for safety and decided I was not going to use it. I was going to test my my internal navigation through the fog with a precipice in all directions around me, and I had to get across the top of a very flat mountain to the other side and then find my descent point. After about 25 minutes of walking, we reached an edge and I was like, this doesn't look familiar. So I turned on my GPS and I'd taken a huge dog leg to the left in the fog. And yeah, so the GPS saved me.
What made you want to go to the northern climes, if we dare say it? Well, why Iceland?
I was working in London, actually, for the Wilderness Foundation and managing a fundraising rock concert, which had me desk-bound working to raise money for their wilderness preservation efforts in Scotland and Europe. And having done that, I very much cultivated a longing within me to follow a path of wilderness exploration and guiding, and I looked into various courses, imagined that I would end up somewhere like South Africa, which I had spent some time in previously and really loved. Yes, yeah, somehow managed to find a fully funded course in international wilderness guiding in Finland, which was a winter orientated course. And yeah, a couple of months later, I had persuaded the man in charge of the course to accept me, although it was only due to someone else dropping out at the last minute. So I took a ferry over to Sweden and started picking blueberries commercially, and then got the call. I was like, ah, great. So I stopped picking blueberries and got on another ferry to Finland and found my way to a little town called Kuru, which is just north of Tampere, and spent the next 12 months interred in a sort of forest cabin doing expeditions to the north, Lapland, West Russia, in a mixture of kind of mediums, walking, canoeing, skiing, snowmobiling, and a sailing trip, actually. So having done that, I then, yeah, I guess, fell in love with the north. I think it was the space, the quality of air, the quality of the environment, which it has a kind of ethereal feel to it. Embarrassingly, it was Facebook that presented this beautiful fjord, large, beautiful mountain behind it. It was advertising a master's program in marine management and conservation ecology, which was my undergraduate topic as well. So this, again, was a fully funded course in Iceland, which I applied to, and it was the first of its kind set up to rejuvenate this town that had been experiencing economic decline for the last 20 years, Isafjörður, which means ice fjord. Looked it up on Google and I just saw this grainy black and white photo of a town covered in snow in the middle of winter. I was like, oh, this is a real outpost. So it tickled my adventurous spirit and I said yes to it. But yeah, it was a really magical year. The studies were great, the group was great, and in between studying, got out into the mountains, met a local sheep farmer who had us chasing around craggy cliffs, seeking her sheep amidst hailstorms and riding little Icelandic ponies to chase the sheep down from the mountains. Yeah, I kind of fell in love with the landscape and the seascape and made some very good friends up there.
And you've been going back and forth there for 10 years?
Yes, yeah, so the course finished in 2009 and then I set up a trail development project in 2013. And then for the next 10 years ran summer-based artist residencies and conservation work camps for roughly 2 weeks, 3 weeks at a time, each project. Sometimes two or three projects a summer, sometimes just one. So a mixture of different formats, but it always evolved and we never repeated ourselves.
Now, Iceland as itself has quite a significant volunteer program for trail maintenance, doesn't it? Was that something that was already going on when you were there, or was it something you could collaborate with, or were you completely separate? And, you know, Iceland's a small territory, but it's a huge territory because places are so remote and, mm-hmm. and physical environment is so stressful for many. It would be for me.
No, there was an organisation called SEEDS, which is a volunteer-based programme which offers international volunteers different experiences. Some of them trail maintenance, some of them photography workshops, other things like that. So yeah, we collaborated with them. They provided the volunteers, we provided the project. And at the same time, we designed our own programmes that sat separately from existing programmes as well. So it's been a kind of journey of building a network around the project and then utilizing different skill sets as we've needed them to move the project forward, both on a kind of physical level but also on a narrative level, whereby we're able to kind of meet funding objectives that we've set ourselves or explore different topics in relation to place, such as old historic herding and walking routes and how they're marked on the land by cairns. And then we looked into cairns and found they were all fallen down on many of these routes. So applied for funding to restore some of these from the European Outdoor Conservation Association and was successful. I had to get a training in stonework because the cultural history institution of Iceland demanded that each cairn that we built was in keeping with what was previously there. And so in order to fulfill that, I joined a stoneworker in north of Scotland for some days, and then made a partnership in Iceland with a guy called Unstein Eliasson, who's a professional stoneworker and who helped train me and joined one of our projects with volunteers as well. So.
Okay, so I mean, this has been a real vacation, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah. Labour of love.
A labour of love. Okay, so tell us a bit more about the book. Try to explain why you felt the book was what you wanted to do, especially, as you've said yourself, you created something that you wouldn't have normally used yourself.
Yeah. We realised that, we had a very beautiful body of knowledge, having run so many programmes with people, often people who would share their reflections, written, photography, artwork, either directly within the experiences, the container, the trails that we were offering, or like subsequently. We initially set out with an aim to stitch together a long distance trail in the region, highlighting ecological and cultural highlights that most tourists who go to the Westfjords were overlooking, because the main focus is to go to the Hornstrande Nature Reserve to the north of the kind of inhabited bit of the land. Ironically, you get a much wilder experience walking the inhabited bit of the land, because there are no tourists there. And so in 10 years of running projects, we've literally never seen anyone else on trail. And so we identified this route, walked it many times, ended up selecting 25 routes that some of them stitched together into multi-day routes, and some of them were detours and dead ends that you could do over a period of like 1 or 2 days. Having kind of got to that stage of identifying these different trails and developing a bit of a story around each one and gathering people's reflections and digital content, it just felt like a very nice way to create a bow around the project and create a format, or offer it through a format that people could then go out and use themselves. Jay had been someone who'd been helping me run projects on the ground in Iceland with these volunteers and artists, and he and I have very different skill sets, both in managing groups and in the production of the books as well. I'm probably the one sort of forging a path ahead and creating a direction and content, and he's provided the vessel, he's provided the tight container and brought it all together around me and between us. When it came to the books, we initially thought that one book would be sufficient to offer the different approaches that we'd offered whilst facilitating groups, and then including information on roots and ecology. And having written for a couple of years, the content, I went over to New York where Jay lives, and he took a look at the content and was like, this is not one book, this is three books and a map. And we decided to follow that slightly ambitious pathway of not just one book but three books and a map. And
the three books are the sort of one which is a sort of you tell me.
Yeah, there's a main kind of book called Wayfinding in the Westfjords, which is an art nature book offering perspectives and approaches to engaging deeply with the region's ecology and different places. So that's part photography book and part poetry and written reflection stories, lots of contributions from people who we've walked with. And then the two smaller books, which you would want to take on trail with you, Notes on Ecology, which features about 80 different plant and animal species. And they're illustrated by a really great Icelandic natural history illustrator, Jón Baldur Hlíðberg. Notes on Walking, which features 25 of our selected walking routes. And then a companion map, which pairs with the Notes on Walking book, but also includes some additional routes that are not in the book as well. That was the aim. I built up a team around it. We ran a Kickstarter initiative and raised the money that we needed to print. And
that's fantastic. That's really good. I've used a kind of crowdfunding for the Urban Tree Festival. It's a humongous amount of work. And you've published the book. And since you've published the book, and if you hadn't published the book, you wouldn't have won a Banff Mountain Festival Award. Because this podcast was born at Banff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because oh, wow. I was on a walking and art residency at the Banff Centre. You've been living part of the time here in an area of Suffolk, and you told me this is Sutton Heath, and we're not far from Woodbridge, and you live not far from here, and you've got family here. But, okay, so the book's done. It's winning lots of awards. what's going on now?
Yeah, my journey in Iceland introduced me whilst I was studying to a field called eco-psychology, which is, yeah, a kind of subfield of psychology, but it's people who use nature as a healing resource in and of itself, based on the writings of Aldo Leopold and Thomas Rozak, who I think was the first kind of guy to write a thick text on what eco-psychology is or could be. That kind of space, that academic field of interest is very experimental and very experiential. Yeah, it's always resonated with me in my guiding, so I try to create spaces where people are able to dialogue with the internal realities that they're carrying and dance with them differently. I use nature primarily as a kind of partner in that process, and so rather than our camps just being pure physical toil and we need to build a path or we need to build a line of cairns along this path, we would weave in moments of reflection where people could see the symbolic nature of building with stone, building in community, building cairns that were often imperfect and had to be tore down and like started again, and that becoming an analogy of, you know, practicing skills within your life or deciding when the cairn itself of life needs to be taken down and, you know, started again. So we've been building up a language of experience for people to be able to then have more empathy for our shared ecology. I was acutely aware that, you know, that's, I guess, more artistic in its approach from a more kind of scientific, rational understanding of the world. But in writing the books, that was, yeah, it was an interesting conversation within me of how much to give voice or give space to the training that I had received through my degrees in terms of them being science-based and kind of explanatory on some level versus the more intangible worlds that I like to play with and have found myself drawn towards more and more, actually. I mean, it's been a difficult transition from finishing the books to now. And
oh, I can appreciate the process of working over and over and bringing in resources and experiences from over a 10-year period, you know. And once it's done, it's sort of given birth to this thing. And then what?
It's not surprising because as you give birth to this project, the project also gives birth to you. Yeah, it created a void in me, not knowing what to do next. And I thought I had to decide immediately. I thought I had to, you know, decide some big life things. It has encouraged an artistic calling within me. Yeah, I've been nurturing that for the last year or more. I've applied to Goldsmith's master's program in art and ecology, but yeah, I'm still deciding whether I'm going to do that, and have found my way to Berlin to do an integral embodiment and performance making part-time training, which I'm currently midway through. Just been, yeah, really fabulous way of re-entering my body, having sat in front of a computer for what turned out to be 4 years and not one or two, in order to get these books out into the world. That too was a strange tension, sitting down to create these books, writing about something that is essentially an embodied experience of being on trail and walking and working with the body. That felt strange at times, but I tried to punctuate it with regular trips to Iceland to gather research information and walking in the mountains, and was successful until the project finished, and then I was just like, ah, what is going on here?
So, okay, so let's get back onto the trails, because one of the things I'm kind of intrigued by is there's a bit of a tension here. You know, you're a chap who likes to wander. You're not too worried about getting lost because you kind of understand what clues there are in the environment to help you get back on track. But trails and the development of trails has very much ended up as a sort of kind of, they're almost linear theme parks.
Yep.
Because what trails are doing is they're linking points that will give you the best view, or they'll give you the best spiritual reflection opportunity, or they'll do something like that. And they're maintained. They have to be maintained. They have to follow a course of least resistance, I suppose. And that's a different tension to what Henry Fletcher seems to be all about.
Yeah, I love that reflection. I think I first read similar lines of thought in Robert Moore's On Trails book. Yeah, you're right. There is a tension around, you know, what is the impact of this work? Like, will this result in more people walking these trails? Or are they so inaccessible and unmarked still, which is kind of the case, as in all of the trails we've included are marked by cairns and cairns only, and pathways are maybe present on 25% of the trails we've included. Otherwise, they're just wandering lines in the landscape where you can take our GPS data if you want, or our map data, and find your way. I love that kind of invitation of creating enough space where you're not directing people, you're inviting them to get safely lost, to follow their intuition in moving through the landscapes. And that's something that I've found great joy in, following myself in terms of how I move off path and allowing my body to choose the route itself. My preferred way of moving is to trespass, I guess, in the UK's kind of context, because we can't follow whatever line we're allowed to, although I try to as much as possible. Yeah, within Iceland there is this rule called Every Man's Right, where you are allowed to walk wherever you choose to walk, wherever your body longs to walk. I'm happy actually where the project landed in that space. There were many people who, at the beginning of the project, when we'd received funding from various government organisations in Iceland, were encouraging rather forcibly that we should be adopting a certain approach where we were videoing every kind of trail and marking it with posts and getting landowner permission to do this, and, you know, opening up this great kind of walkway, I guess, in the mountains. And yeah, it never resonated with me and I never followed it, and like broke off a few professional partnerships as a result of it, and followed this, yeah, the meandering kind of like ethos. And
okay, so how does that sit with being a member of the World Trails Network? Perhaps you could tell us briefly what the World Trails Network is, and then what your involvement is.
Yeah, so the World Trails Network is a collection of trail organizations and trail enthusiasts and managers, developers. Primarily, it's a destination development tool. They see trails as that, as ways of getting people out into nature, bringing people to their destination, highlighting different eco-cultural highlights. And yeah, part of me that loves being able to, say, go to Lebanon, a country that I knew nothing about, and being held within the container of a long-distance trail. It's designed in such a way that you stay with local people along the route, you eat with local artisans. It's a curated experience on some level, but it's done with such a loving intention and nuance that actually it feels less important to be able to wander freely in a completely unknown place, and actually be, it feels like more like an invitation to appreciate a different culture, a different ecology. That is the flip side, the other side of the kind of designed trail experience is if you do it with sensitivity, then it can be a very powerful tool and a very, you know, very powerful experience.
Continuing on then, you're being quite careful here. You're not actually revealing what your role is in the World Trails Network.
My role has, it's evolved at various points. Initially, I was invited to present the work that I was doing in Iceland at their conference in Santiago in Spain. They have a conference every 2 years where members are invited to present their work, learn from each other, and celebrate trail culture, essentially. So I presented there, loved the experience of being part of this festival of walking, essentially. And they call it a conference, but it's definitely more of a festival of walking and a celebration. And from that gathering, I joined the media task team. So it's a volunteer-based led organization made up of 8 or 10 different task teams. And you can join these task teams and carry out actions in between the conferences. And so the media task team decided that it would develop a film festival for trails, so showcasing different film trail stories from all over the world. And I went to the second conference in Greece, where, again, I'd published by this point, and I was giving a reading there of the work. And that's where I met Ali Pretty, who runs Kinetica and the Beach of Dreams project. She invited me to join her arts and culture task team within the World Trails Network. And so I've been, over the past year, helping set up and manage a program of online talks exploring the role artists take and contribute to celebrating trail culture, how walking artists use walking as part of their practice, and using it really as a kind of exploratory platform to help connect people from different artistic mediums, using walking as a kind of like departure point. So we've had projects from India, Costa Rica, America, the UK, France, present their work, and often it's community-driven work. It's really fascinating conversation that's happening once a month.
I'm going to ask you to recommend a couple of walks. So you're going to find it kind of tough, but to choose two. But briefly, can you offer listeners a couple of walks?
Yes, so I would firstly recommend walking along Lautrebjerg Cliffs in June, which is the end point of our trail in Iceland, or the beginning point, depending on which way you're walking. But it's a gorgeous stretch of 17 kilometers of sea cliff overlooking the Atlantic Ocean. And in the spring, around this time of year, May, June, it is packed full of different nesting birds. The whole cliff face is just thronging with life and noise and shit, and it's just one of the most spectacular scenes that you can imagine on trail. Yeah, there's no fence to speak of, and you're literally just on a very vertical cliff edge, watching these birds going about their business. And if you go there at midnight, you see the midnight sun. Yeah, just a very special place, and beaches sort of in close proximity, and a lovely, wonderful hotel called Hotel Breidavik. It used to be a boarding school, and they've converted it into a hotel. That would be my first recommendation. I'm currently practicing divination with a traditional healer from Botswana, and there's an online kind of course that's helping people on the course cultivate the diviner within. And one of the exercises we're being asked to do is a tracking exercise whereby you choose a path in your local vicinity, wherever that may be it in a park in a city, or a forest, or a meadow, or some combination thereof. And you choose a start point, and then 3 points in the middle, and then a final fifth point. And you walk this path every single day, and you stop at each point, at the same point, and you take in as much of the territory, the tracking line, the observations, the perceptions, both visual and sensory in your whole body, as you can, and you begin to situate yourself on that tracking line. The repeated practice of doing that allows you to situate yourself in place in a way that I haven't experienced before. You become permeable to that place, and that place becomes permeable to you. And there's an added kind of element to that exercise in that every time you, just before going to sleep, you recall as many details as you can remember about the walk that you've just taken earlier in the day along those 5 points. So you recall, you visit the first point in your imaginal body and recall as many details as you can from that moment. The things you were feeling, the thoughts you were thinking, the things you were seeing, things you were hearing. And yeah, it's a wonderful way of carrying a landscape within you and developing a space for a landscape to exist within you, and you begin to develop a syntax, a language in response to that place. And if you feel called to, you can then begin to have more intentional conversations with that space by ritually asking questions that you may be holding within yourself to these different points and seeing what answers it offers in response. That's my other walk I would encourage you to do.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from Henry Fletcher. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we'd love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.